Hello, everyone, and welcome to Historia Canadiana, the show where we talk about culture and history and politics, pretty much anything we want to, really. But the point today is that I'm bringing you something from behind the Patreon paywall, right? We're unlocking an episode because I'm going to be away for a few weeks and I didn't have time to record something new before I left. I know I asked some people out on social media what they would like, and you know, people like Brett, for example, who follows the show, suggested that I maybe do an episode on Marianne Shad, which sounds really interesting and I want to get into it, but I just didn't have the time to do so between organizing and finishing up some work, so all kinds of stuff. Anyway, this is going to be a random cultural episode with a strong focus on music in this case. I actually have something a bit different for you today. I have an interview with an old professor of mine from my time at Concordia, a man by the name of Professor Daniel O'Leary, who is an expert in 19th century Canadian literature and culture, and who specializes in all kinds of other things like Victorian literature, Irish literature in Canada, and so on and so forth. While he wasn't specifically part of the music department at Concordia, his interests definitely intersected with the broad cultural interests of Canadian music and folk traditions, being a musician himself and being deeply concerned with the way in which music was evolving in Canada from the early times that there was music that was distinctly Canadian up until today. He was very instrumental in my path as a scholar, and this is an interview that I conducted with him for a project a few years ago, and I thought it would be relevant. I think it's an insightful conversation, even though I don't necessarily agree with him 100%. So without further ado, I'm going to bring us right into the show after a brief musical interlude. And just to give you some context, this is an interview concerning, broadly speaking, a music show that was airing from the 50s and 60s up until the 70s. That was called Don Messer's Sing-Along Jubilee, that highlighted all kinds of Canadian folk artists that came on and basically played on CBC Radio, Canada's national television and radio station. That initial conversation led to a series of other topics concerning music in Canada, but that was the basic gist of it at the start. So without further ado, I'll send you right into this episode. I hope you enjoy it and tell me what you think. Obviously, if you want to hear more of the show while we're on a brief hiatus, please don't hesitate to support us on Patreon. You'll have plenty of back catalog to choose from. Just because we unlock one once in a while doesn't mean that there isn't still plenty of content to find there, or you can just listen to our back catalog. Anyway, I've rambled on long enough. Here we go. On to the episode.
In the town of Spring Hill, Nova Scotia, down in the back of the Cumberland mine, there's blood on the coal and the miners lie in the roads that never saw sun nor sky, roads that never saw sun nor sky.
Well, it started on the radio in the I think the late 40s, early 50s. Not Sing Along Jubilee exactly, but the people who put the show together. The Don Messer's Jubilee, of course, goes back on CBC to the early 60s, I think. Although it had been on the radio earlier than that, and I think Don Messer's group had a radio show in Prince Edward Island in the late 30s and 40s as well. So quintessentially Canadian. And in the Maritimes, it was taken as almost the national music of the country. I think across the country, it was a popular show. What I remember was that it used to run before Hockey Night in Canada, so it always had that guaranteed audience. Mm-hmm. And
people would stick around all the way.
Yes, that's right. Well, I think in those days, many, many households had the radio on just on CBC and just left on. So whatever was on became iconic Canadian culture. But of course, it was a different Canada. It was much more unified Canada. And so, and I think these sorts of shows had a great deal to do with that.
What do you think was the importance of Don Messer's Sing-Along Jubilee? What do you think it accomplished in terms of Canadian culture?
The key thing about the show was its defense of non-commercial idea of Canadian music. And they tended to feature guests who were essentially folk singers. But in Canada, it was different from Britain or America, where you have Tin Pan Alley construction or reconstruction of a kind of mythic folk music that was really a rebirth rather than a continuation of a tradition.
And it wasn't the same in Canada. It seems like they really wanted to go into a different direction.
In the Maritimes, it was quite a different situation. There was still a very, very strong rural folk music tradition passed along, culturally passed along in kitchens, not by records and radio. And so a lot of what you heard on shows like Sing Along Jubilee and Don Messer's Jubilee were country dance music that had its roots in Europe in the 18th century.
It was a voluntary choice to have that kind of music as part of our history, or?
Well, I think the people who ran the show, especially people like Don Messer, it was less political than evidence of an authentic living culture. Really, there was no choice. It was just a representation of what actually people were playing, you know, in lumber camps or on boats.
Switching gears a bit, what kind of instruments were used typically during these folk songs? Was it something that was typically from Canada, or was it imported from Europe? What are we talking about here?
One of the key things were the instruments that were used. A lot of fiddle, of course. A lot of old-fashioned slide guitar with a kind of slide but played gospel style on the lap, mm-hmm. like a lap guitar. Certainly squeeze boxes, button accordions, less concertinas had died out by that time. They were rare, but lots of button accordions. And the style of playing was very like what you hear all over Northern Europe. Many of the pieces I remember hearing as a child in New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, I've heard very similar things from Finland, Norway, Denmark, as well as, of course, all over Britain.
But I mean, there was still a variety of genres that could potentially come out of Europe. Was there one that really stands out to you as being a noticeable influence, or is it pretty generalized European, as you say?
I get the feeling that much of that music really was rooted in 19th century nautical culture. I've heard very similar music from New Zealand, Australia, South Africa even. You get this type of music, but particularly in Northern Europe and on both sides of the Atlantic. So it really was a survival of something that was outside of all the things Adorno complains about in jazz, you know, this corruption or pollution that comes from commercial distribution being centralized. And so the control of the aesthetic of popular music is always through an American imperial lens rather than through anthropology or through sociology. It's taken up with the American zeitgeist. And I think very consciously many of the people involved in projects like the Don Messer Show were aware of their Canadian status as somehow cultural resistance to what was going on. And at the time those shows were on was at the height of the changes in Canada. There was a great deal of anxiety in the country at the time about these things. You get works like George Grant's Lament for a Nation coming out in 65.
Which you think has something to do with music?
In a certain way, he was talking about the Beatles. He was talking about Elvis. He was talking about the way in which the musical imagination in Canada was being displaced. I don't know that he talks about music specifically, but essentially the cultural politics he's talking about relate to these things. And from that point of view, the invasion of Canada from a musical point of view, after the late 40s, people like Frank Sinatra and Bing Crosby and that group, their real part musical history was not finally musical, but rather had to do with the organizing of a distribution network that allowed for monopolization. And that's really the issue in all of this, is the monopolization of Canadian music, so that eventually Canadians who want to be heard, even under Canadian content laws, have to play in an American style, just so that they have the reach to take part in the game, you know, to be part of that system. And so I fall back to Adorno. Adorno said, he used the example of Ma Rainey, the great blues singer from the early 20th century, who is a genius. But what he said was, it doesn't matter what the charm of an individual Ma Rainey recording is. And I would say the same about Bob Dylan or, the Beatles. The real problem is the fact that they are produced, by the devil. They're produced by a centralized distribution system that has ultimately the power of censorship. It also has the power of choice. It can choose what values it represents.
So to you, acts like Bob Dylan and the Beatles are nothing special. They're products of an American production system more than actual talent.
That is the other great aspect of this, or the important aspect, is that our assumption that the Beatles or Bob Dylan are genii is largely a product of our misunderstanding of the mechanism, because the grooming of the music that they produce, the production of it, the use of modern methods of completing recordings so that they have a commercial finish, is not the product of Bob Dylan or John Lennon. It's the product of George Martin or whoever the technician was who created that sound. And the sound is coming out of, in a sense, publishing houses. It's coming out of a mechanism, not out of individual artists. Now, it is a way of showing artists or giving artists a particular kind of stage. But once an artist is in that system, it's hard from a philosophical point of view to just accept it and judge it as if it's the same as Bach or Beethoven, because it's a different phenomenon. And psychologically, the use of course, Adorno sounds a little dated when he talks about syncopated rhythm, but the point he's making about syncopated rhythm, he talks about the fact that one of the dangers of jazz particularly is its use of certain types of rhythms that have a subliminal attraction that is not musical, but rather appeals to something more physiological. And, from a music listener's point of view, you might say, well, that's the point, that intensify the pleasure of the experience. But in my mind, it creates a problem. It creates certainly a revulsion. And certainly from the point of view of content, I mean, I always pick Dylan as an example because he's so controversial. He has such a cult. But as somebody who's studied poetry for decades, I don't find poetry in Dylan in the sense that I find poetry in Wordsworth. There is no coherence, there's no philosophical coherence. The values that emerge from it are basically a pale version of what you get from the Beats. Your life is 12 inches long. If you use 9 inches of your life, with the Beats, you've only got 3 inches left for real literature. And there is a real literature there. There is something better than that, And it's, I would say in music, it is possible to screen work that is too intimately wound up in that commercial system that I think is very destructive. These assumptions have to be challenged, I think, in the rest of the world, especially Canada, because until this system took over, Canada had a very established culture, and until that time, the culture we had was a very healthy one. It emphasized classical virtues, it emphasized civilitas, dignitas. Most young people, even if they don't know anything about Canadian culture, know that the stereotype of Canadians is that of the polite Canadian. The idea that the future utopia is going to grow out of Woodstock is absurd, and that's still where we are, in allowing our domination by a forced nostalgia for a past that's not even our own. And so these musical questions are central. They're very important.
So that was a lot in one go. If I was to condense your point down to a more palatable idea, it's that the importance of the show is that it was quintessentially Canadian pre, air quotes, American pollution.
Yes, or in a sense, detached from the considerations of modern commercial recordings.
Right.
It partly comes down to a kind of reader response sense of what's going on. Who is the audience for this? And the audience of Sing Along Jubilee is a Canadian audience that had been formed by the nation building of two or three centuries, and very distinct from, you know, the Bobby Soxers and the Zoot Suiters of the 50s and 40s and 50s. It clearly is trying to carry on Canadian ideas about music that really, as I said already, are rooted in a deep history. They go back into the 18th century. Partly, it is the vestigial survival of the folk and country dance music culture of the 19th century, when every Canadian village had at least a half dozen fiddlers, and everybody danced all the time, where people played music in their houses. When there was no recorded music,
exactly.
You know, most people played something. It was only the spoons. And if you couldn't play something, you could sing a ballad. You had a half dozen songs you knew. And people had this music all of the time. Even when I was a child, in the Maritimes, it was very, very common for people to play music in the kitchen by the wood stove before the hockey game on a Saturday night or other occasions, or in the barns or whatever. And the music that was played was the standard repertoire of the traditional music of Western Europe.
For lack of a better word, could you say it was rustic in a sense?
Yes, and acoustic particularly.
Yes. Okay.
That's the main thing. I know myself, I play traditional music, and I stay away from mics, I stay away from speakers.
Just out of principle?
Yeah. No, I don't want to sound too conservative about all of this. It doesn't mean if I'm at a party I kick over the iPod dock if the Rolling Stones come on. But I do get a bit sniffy about purely commercial music, and especially mass cultural music.
Right. Okay. Everybody has to listen to the same thing.
Everybody has to be nostalgic for the American
yeah.
past. That's what they sell. Constant cycle of nostalgia for a music that's not our own. You know, being alert to the aesthetic dimension of this is very important. And, you know, you're not going to escape that matrix by listening to hip-hop. You're not going to escape that matrix by taking up any of the American subcultures. They are all imbued with what is finally an American view of the world. It has an ontological gravity or understanding. And this is why we feel we have to take part in the American squabble, because that's what this music is representing, are the stresses within the American culture. Now, I have to say, I understand that it is more difficult for Canadians who don't come from an old Canadian background to identify with this culture.
Well, I guess that leads to the next point, and we'll get right into it. Why do you think people have a tendency to think of people like Céline Dion first when thinking of Canadian music, or even here in Quebec, the Colocs, who were very popular in the 90s?
Well, because they fall into American forms. They completely submit to American generic expectations. They're easily packaged to fit into those genres, which are just systems of commercial distribution. Their content is exactly the same. As a matter of fact, the two examples you use are, to my mind, wonderful examples about how Quebec, in pursuing its national aspirations and being encouraged to pursue its national aspirations, has intensified the Americanization of French culture in Quebec. That's not to say there isn't a lively traditional music scene here, but one of the things as a traditional music I've witnessed in Quebec is a kind of ghettoization of Quebec traditional music, where as a maritime musician, I often witness a kind of tension at events where there is a predominance of traditional music fans from Quebec, because they all associate that with an anti-Canadian nationalist movement in which, you know, people like me represent the invader. Now, from my point of view, that is a deep misconception that leaves aside the long presence, not just in English Canada, but in Quebec, of the culture of Canada, of English Canada, you know. for 150 years of the history I'm talking about, the sort of music you heard on Don Messer was also played in Sherbrooke and Thetford and places like that. I mean,
It was everybody's music.
it was everybody's music. That's right. And you even hear it, like when you really listen to the early Quebec folk music, it sounds strikingly like what you hear being played on Don Messer and Sing-Along Jubilee. And in fact, many of the musicians on those shows were Franco-Canadians. Charlie Chamberlain was one of the stars of the show, and Chamberlain was an Acadian. He even sang often in French, and his style was a very French style. But he was a key part of that musical scene. And in the Maritimes, you had the same thing. I often say this, that the music of Acadia, of French, the French Maritimes, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, PEI, was virtually identical to that of Cape Breton. Very, very little difference. They played a little bit more in B flat and used different keys sometimes, and there were pieces played that were more French than others, but generally they were the same types of what we would think of as square dances and those sorts of things, and the same basic repertoire. And what's happened to traditional music in the Maritimes is that false history has replaced the real culture. So you get young Acadians taking up zydeco music rather than playing their own music because of this false commercial idea that Cajun and Acadian are the same thing.
C'était la fille d'un fermier au bon Dieu, elle était belle. C'était la fille d'un fermier au bon Dieu, elle était belle.
So just to clarify, would it be fair to say that there's an issue with authenticity in Canadian music, or?
There are philosophical problems with these words like authenticity. What is authentic? That may be a legitimate complaint. If you're born into the situation where the zeitgeist is controlled by these things, well, taking part in them is natural enough. I suppose, in a sense, what I'm implying is that we need some kind of rearguard action to preserve what does survive, because it does survive. I mean, it's not as healthy as it was in the past. But there are still a lot of people who feel deep anxiety about these things, and wince when Justin Trudeau tries to tell us there's no core culture in Canada.
If you'll allow me to return to a conversation we actually had a few weeks ago, I think there's something to be said about, people really knowing who Céline Dion is, right? She has a sold-out show in Las Vegas, and groups from the past, like the 60s and 70s, like Harmonium, who toured extensively in California. Where do you think the line is with conserving authenticity, but people actually knowing of Canadian artists, right? Everybody knows that. Right, Céline Dion is from here. Is there anything to be said to that extent about sacrificing a bit of authenticity for at least recognition?
Okay, in a certain sense, we're comparing two different things at that point. The Canadians who buy into that system and become famous in an American context are doing something very different from Don Messer did not expect to make $1 million, recording fiddle music. He hoped that he would make enough money to pay his rent, which he kind of did.
He wanted to appeal to Canadian culture in that sense.
Yes, he had no interest in being the next Frank Sinatra. Your examples are quite various in a sense. I mean, I don't think those issues have ever occurred to Céline Dion. I think Harmonium is a different case because there you have a sheen of traditional music or a kind of gesture towards traditional music, even the name of the band, Harmonium. Harmonium is one of the old squeeze box instruments that was played widely in Canada in the late 18th and early 19th century, sort of the precursors to accordions. In their music, they sometimes sing songs that have historical themes, but in a sense, they're one of those dangerous examples where a rock and roll ethos. You look photographs of the band at that time, they would have been, their whole aesthetic is American. It comes out of, the hippie movement, and they would have been very comfortable in San Francisco in 1967, and that was their culture. And so their nostalgia for the past is all through the lens of the Quiet Revolution. And I think if I remember, I haven't heard Harmonium in 25 years, but I used to listen to them. And it seems to me they even had songs in which the English are the enemies. And
Yeah, I don't remember either. It's just an example I got off the top of my head.
now they
But yeah.
do. What I would say about a band like that is you have to be careful in a positive sense, because they're a gateway band to a purer kind of authenticity. You can move if you get Harmonium and pick up on those elements in it. It may lead you to a deeper understanding of less commercial examples of that. And in the right mood, they're okay. I'd rather hear Harmonium in the Walmart than the Eagles or the Beach Boys.
Yeah.
I don't very often,
I don't think I've ever heard them.
No, and you probably never heard Don Messer or
Nope.
Charlie Chamberlain in a Walmart either, and neither have I.
And I don't think you ever will at this
No,
point.
you won't. And I see the attempts by commercial distribution systems to insinuate that the culture of the Maritimes is really hillbilly culture of the United States, that shit-kicking music is what the natural music of the Maritimes is. And that's wrong on a half dozen different levels.
Yes.
The first myth that because you had large Northern Irish population in both places, that therefore they're the same people. But in fact, those that came to Canada because of their opposition to those that went to the United States. And culturally, there's a deep division in that community. It exists in Northern Ireland even today. And the other, you used the word rustic at one point. That's a big issue here. The
Custom.
fact, well, just because the Canadian population is increasingly urban, when this culture we're talking about was overwhelmingly
Rural.
rural. And part of the key to the survival of that culture was that rural transmission of music that you see. And it's very exciting in a way, looked at in the right way. You listen to some of these early recordings from the early part of the 20th century in the Maritimes, and they're really preserving aspects of music that go back right into the medieval period and the Dorian scale of the music of the medieval period. And many of the jigs and reels you hear are very ancient. Very frequently you'll find ballads from the 15th, 16th century in which the underlying music is perfectly recognizable. That comes out of the folk repertoire.
Now, is this something that applies to instruments as well, or?
The stability of the forms of instruments that we use are that deep. Bagpipe keyboards are the same as they've always been, and there's a certain type of music that emerges from technique in the sense of the keyboard imbued in the forms of those types of instruments. Now, harmoniums and squeeze boxes and so on are later, they're invented late 18th, early 19th century, but they were back engineered. They were made so that they could play the established repertoire, and the whole idea was that they were cheaper than brass instruments, but
Yeah.
could play with the brass play. They could play with fiddles and play the same things that fiddles play. And therefore, they were conservative instruments, backward looking. And in Canada, the music that was played on those instruments came to an end very, very suddenly, right around the start of the 20th century, for reasons that were very analogous to what happened in the 50s. And that was the invasion of the Canadian catalog market, which previously had been supplied by Canadian firms, a Hudson Bay Company, a British firm, and Eaton's and Simpson's. Those were the catalog firms that
Yeah.
supplied musical instruments. If you look at those catalogs, they all sell the instruments of the 19th century musical culture. They sell cheap concertinas, they sell button accordions, they sell piano accordions, harmonicas, but not banjos, and not country guitars, and not the sort of instruments that you play hillbilly music on. Now, when The catalog business is conceded to Sears in the early part of the 20th century, almost overnight. Two things happen. First of all, those instruments that played the 19th century music are suddenly antiquated because everybody's young wants the new thing.
Yeah.
The other thing is the change in pitch, which happens at that time. The American domination of world music meant that they actually changed the standard pitch of concert music, dropping it down a third of a note around, I don't know what year, 1905, 1906, something like that. So virtually overnight, all of the settled keyed instruments, so anything that couldn't be tuned up to that pitch or down, whichever the case was, became irrelevant. Yes. So now, that wasn't just instruments. That was a musical culture being buried.
So long expected, hail the year of full release. Zion's walls are now erected, and her watch and published peace.
So you were talking about how music has shifted, right? The change in pitch, or you mentioned earlier hip-hop, which rose up in the 70s in the midst of...
Yeah, which I should intervene and say, when I say that about hip-hop, what I said about that not being the way, I don't really have in mind the kind of quasi-traditional hip-hop that people sang outdoors or in their at a party or whatever on their own. I'm talking more about the word hip-hop.
Yeah.
This idea of music evolving has come up a few times. Where do you think Canadian music should go? Because in my own personal opinion, I don't think it's reasonable to say that it could go back to what it was at the time of Don Messer's Jubilee.
No, I don't foresee fully recovering that aesthetic. I mean, that music came out of the conditions of the time and out of a country in which most people lived in rural settings, where that sort of music was appropriate. But what I would like to see is more critical thinking and more awareness of the fact that there is ideological freight in art and in music, and that we're not unchanged by what we consume. And so being aware of that, and the other thing I have to confess, is that after years of being passionate about music, you know, I realize I live, and especially teaching in the university, I know that there are many of my colleagues who object to distinguishing between high and low art, between classical music and other music. And I increasingly am impatient with that fearfulness. But it does not mean that there is no difference between Bach and Beethoven and Céline Dion and, you know, the Eagles, because there is. Classical music is written after years of training. It operates according to codes. The longer that you listen and the more you know, the more that the music unfolds. It has philosophical themes that are engaging with intellectual movements at the time the music is being composed. So what I would like to see sensitive people do is open themselves up more to academic and music, or to difficult music, because then you understand why it is that there's a problem if you're an intelligent person to spend your life obsessed nostalgically with, you know, the pop music you listened to when you were 16. There was a 19th century philosopher named Hare, Augustus Hare, who used a kind of method of the apotheme. He had philosophical propositions, and one of them was that nostalgia is a disease of the imagination. And what he meant by that was that if we are obsessed nostalgically, we are infantile. We're not developing the way that we can develop.
Cool.
So if Canada is to go about having a wider audience in their music, how do you think it would go about doing that?
Well, you're maybe asking the wrong person, because I don't care about a wider audience outside of Canada for Canadian music. I worry about that whole structure, because it's all positing a kind of idea of the musician as some kind of hero or as some kind of star. And it's the star system that I'm at war with. I don't care about stars. I don't care about top 100. I don't care about any of that. I don't think we need rock stars. The world is not going to be saved by rock stars. This leads to broken and disappointed lives, because if you waste your young life pursuing a dream of that kind, that statistically is not going to happen, you know, one in 1,000 or one in 5,000 gets to be the rich pop star. Everybody else gets to live a life of misery and in which you have no profession. And so I think music should be something everybody does, that music should be a dynamic part of everybody's life. And that's how I answer that question. I don't care about the Celine Dion's. I don't think that's a healthy psychological model. And certainly seems to me being philosophical is more important than having a hit. The other thing is that I think that I wouldn't be as quick to say that a revival of Canadian music is absurd as all that. You know, I think young musicians should be listening to Stan Rogers and to Don Messer and Canadian musicians of that kind. I think we should be singing our own songs. And one example of that, and I think of Barrett's Privateers would be a good, good example. And that is a Canadian anthem. We need more of that. The Sing-Along Jubilee recording, it has a song on there called the Spring Hill Mining Disaster, which is a traditional music. I want to call it a classic, but it's fairly esoteric in some respects. But that's the sort of song I would like to see people singing. It's not nostalgia, it's memory. It remembers the loss of
harkening back to our history.
That's right. And also a political complaint. It, you know, it calls for change. It calls for decent treatment of working people. And that was the Canada that people loved in the 19th century. It was the idea that Canada was always getting better. That Canada was a place where working people were treated like human beings, where everybody had the rights of Englishmen, not just the aristocrats. And, you know, that language is outdated now, but the idea should be the same.
Just to cap this all off, what do you think people should get out of this exchange that we've just had today?
Again, I break it into two things. One, that there is a Canadian archive and there are recordings like Don Messer and so on that indicate the existence or prove the existence of a core culture that is a very valuable resource right now. We have values of our own, and so read Canadian books. Look at early Canadian poems. Listen to early Canadian music, just to understand who you are. And secondly, that if you're a musician, to play that music, to make it live, to bring it alive. And that I know can be done because I do it myself, and I have lots of friends who do it. And it leads to a really exciting. I understand the attraction of nationalism in Quebec. There's a very strong psychological reinforcement that comes from a sense of unity. And Canadians used to have that. And I think we still do, but we're afraid to talk about it. And we're afraid to acknowledge it or to embody it. And sometimes you will, and when you take that view, you'll find beautiful, beautiful things. That song, Spring Hill Mining Disaster, that I talk about on that record, is deeply moving. I mean, it's a wonderful, wonderful piece of music. And there's Don Messer is one of the great traditional fiddlers.
Yeah.
Madame Bolduc here in Quebec, for instance, was a great genius and very much in that tradition. When you listen to the music of her and her members of her family, it's outside of that Tin Pan Alley kind of mold. It's coming out of Quebec. It's coming out of Canada. And is very, very charming.
Well, thank you again, Professor O'Leary, for being on the show.
Thank you for the opportunity.